Welcome to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. Saturday afternoon is when staff at the American Embassy in Caracas have to leave. At least that's the deadline imposed by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. This week, the United States recognized a different leader of Venezuela, though, Juan Guaido. He's the leader of the National Assembly, which holds no power under Maduro. Some American diplomats and their families have been leaving, according to the Associated Press on this Friday. The White House said it would reduce staff levels but keep the embassy open. That was Guaido on Wednesday this week swearing himself in as interim president. He made his first public appearance today giving a speech, and in that speech, he urged the Venezuelan military to abandon the Maduro regime.
Pónganse del lado del pueblo de Venezuela. Van a tener en los próximos días una prueba importante. Varias tienen ya. Primera con su conciencia y sus familiares. Esa es la primera.
It has been a week of fast-moving developments in Venezuela, in Washington, and here in South Florida. Do you have family or friends, colleagues in Venezuela? How do you feel about the United States recognizing Guaido as the president of Venezuela? And what assistance should South Florida, what assistance should the American government provide? 800-743-WLRN, the developments in Venezuela up first here on the South Florida Roundup, an international story, a hemispheric story, but a local story for us here in South Florida, certainly. 800-743-9576, or you can tweet us your thoughts at WLRN. Our America's correspondent here at WLRN is Tim Padgett. Tim, let's begin with Guaido. He just finished up within the last hour or so giving this first public speech. He had kind of been in hiding over the past few days after swearing himself in. What did he have to say? What was the purpose of this speech, and what was the message?
Well, two main points that he made. One is that he's calling for another round of big, massive protest marches in Caracas and throughout Venezuela on Saturday. As you mentioned, that's the same day that U.S. diplomats have been ordered out of the country by Maduro. More important, though, he said that on Sunday, he and the rest of the opposition leadership would unveil what he calls a ley de amnistía, an amnesty law, which would essentially offer amnesty to all of the military generals and soldiers, rank and file, who defect from the Maduro regime, come over to the opposition and create this new transitional government, which would then hold new elections, presidential elections. That's the key thing, because if the military doesn't abandon the Maduro regime, this gambit that we saw this week recognizing Guaido as the, quote, legitimate president of Venezuela really isn't going to go anywhere.
So it was, what, just 24 hours or so ago that the top generals, according to, to Maduro, said pledged their support to the current regime.
And they're likely to dig in on that because they are simply too entrenched with the Maduro regime, both in terms of ideology, but more important, in terms of corruption. Maduro has simply made it too lucrative and fruitful for these military officers, whether it's drug trafficking, whether it's holding ministries. For example, PDVSA, the state-run oil industry in Venezuela, is now run by Major General Manuel Quevedo. So, you know, there's just too much at stake for these officers to suddenly abandon, you know, second guess their loyalty to Maduro, let alone abandon it.
What about the rank and file? Is that who was directed for this message from Guaido?
That could be a big factor, because we also saw this week about 27 National Guardsmen in Caracas stage a very brief mutiny that was put down. But it does indicate that the rank and file, as you said, which is very poorly paid and is not enjoying the fruits of the corruption in the ministry, official ships, etc., is feeling a lot of discontent, and they could be defecting.
So who's in charge of Venezuela?
Technically, the military. The military are in charge because, just for the reasons I just laid out, without them, Maduro has no power. And it's up to them to decide whether they stay with him or move to Guaido in the opposition. And so, in effect, they are the head of state of Venezuela.
But certainly not the recognized head of state, right, according to kind of international diplomacy.
Well, the United States and a host of Latin American countries, I think you have to realize how significant that is. That is a real break from Latin American history to see this many Latin American countries turn on a fellow Latin American government this way.
So other Latin American countries recognizing Guaido.
Guaido, exactly, including Brazil and Colombia. They're two big neighbors. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is highly significant. The problem is, can this move that the United States and Guaido have made to recognize him as the real president of Venezuela, can that resonate strongly enough with the rest of the international community to then translate into enough pressure, mm-hmm, on Venezuela to make the military reconsider its loyalty to Maduro?
That international community also includes the non-governmental organizations that have tried to provide some kind of material support for Venezuelans on the ground dealing with this economic collapse over the past several years. Mario Di Giovannin is with us. He is with the International Democratic Network, Red Democratica Internacional, an NGO promoting democracy. Mario, with us here. Tell us, what is that support, and what are you hearing out of Venezuela? What kind of support is necessary, and how's that changed in the last 4 days?
I think the main thing that has changed in the last few days is the hope of Venezuelans abroad of seeing change in our country and trying to, or finally getting to a point that we're going to avoid this misery and the violence that has consumed Venezuela for the past many years. Many are hopeful of going back, flying back to Venezuela and going back home. Venezuela has many necessities. If we go into the humanitarian side, there's a strong lack of medicine, there's lack of food. So part of the work that a lot of NGOs must do outside is try to come together and continue sending all these supplies that are needed. It's been a challenge in the last few years because of the challenge of working with the government, mm-hmm, but hopefully that will be overcome.
Have you seen a change in demand and requests out of Venezuela, or for that matter, a change in the ability to provide the kind of resources from South Florida into Venezuela because of the developments in the last week?
I cannot say that we've seen technical change yet, but we are hopeful that with all the different changes and the efforts that have been made by Guaido and the people surrounding him, mm-hmm, we will see change soon enough to start sending in an easier way the supplies to Venezuela.
Laura Weffer is also with us, co-founder of Efecto Cucuyo, an independent digital news outlet based in Caracas. Laura is on the telephone with us. Laura, what should Venezuelans expect in terms of support from Americans, given the actions over the last 4 days, and what do they need?
I think the attitude of Nicolas Maduro has been changing in the last few hours towards the United States. 2 days ago, or not even 2 days ago, I will say 1 day ago, he was bragging and being extremely defiant towards the United States. Mm-hmm. I was just listening to the press conference that he was giving, and his tone is so much more humble. He even said that he is willing to talk to Guaido in whatever conditions Guaido settles. He said that he's willing even to go naked to talk to him. I don't know why he made that comment. It's really with no explanation. But the attitude of Maduro towards the United States has been changing.
And what do you, Laura? What do you attribute that to? That kind of turnaround in tone in a day or day and a half?
International pressure.
Yeah.
International pressure. As we speak, there are talks right now, high-ranked talks from European countries. Within European countries, they are divided on what kind of position they have to take looking Venezuela. Spain has a position more, mm-hmm, more prone to put some contacts with Venezuela and with Maduro specifically. France, on the other hand, try to get more to Guaido, but even within them, they are divided. So for the first time in many, many years, we are looking to an international community that is taking actions towards United States, sorry, towards Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what is making them change, at least their tone. You know, there has been other times when the Venezuelan government speaks, you know, one day you see them like very brave and, you know, I don't care what you said to me. And the other day they are humble. But this time I think it's different.
Laura, let me...
And I think what makes even more significant is the fact that Maduro just recognized Guaido as the person that he needs to talk to.
Hmm. Laura Weffer is the co-founder of Efecto Cucuyo, an independent digital news outlet based in Caracas. Stick with us, Laura. Your colleague in Caracas, Juliette Pineda, is along with us now via Skype. Juliette, self-declared interim president, Guaido, speaking today, calling for a new round of marches tomorrow. What to expect in Caracas on Saturday over the weekend?
Well, we are expecting a lot of people to come out this next few days because, well, the situation is expectant. People are feeling a lot of euphoria because they are back in the streets again after all the situation and all the repression from the security forces back in 2017. But also there's a lot of tension. However, I believe and I the people here are willing to keep going out and keep going to demonstrations because of what Laura just said. We see Nicolas Maduro is showing this change of tone. It's turning around and saying he's willing to discuss and to dialogue with Juan Guaido. And they're showing kind of like a weak side we haven't seen before because they're also having a rally right now in La Guaira, a coast state in Venezuela, and you don't see as much people as Hugo Chavez used to have in their rallies.
Mm. Mario Di Giovanni, let me ask you how the diaspora here in South Florida should kind of absorb a bit of this change in tone that Laura and Juliette are talking about.
I think the diaspora has an important role in communicating what's really happening in Venezuela, explaining the complexity of this process. I've seen in the past few days a lot of, especially U.S. congressmen and women, discussing that this could be a U.S.-led coup, that this could be a U.S. trying to change the regime. This is a lot more than that, and it's not even that. It's an effort that has been going on for many years, and saying that it's simply a U.S. coup is undermining the efforts and the bravery of so many Venezuelans that have exposed themselves for this cause. And it also goes beyond to what Tim was saying previously. The many countries that are supporting or giving their support to Guaido, including countries such as Canada, many of the Latin American countries, different countries in Europe. So the diaspora really has a role in explaining the complexity and explaining how this is not a coup. This is something recognized on our constitution, and that's what we're trying to do.
Laura and Juliette, Laura, you first. Do you sense a difference between the situation today as it's developed with Guaido and what Venezuela and Caracas experienced in 2015 when we saw kind of an outpouring of support for opposition leaders?
Well, I feel right now in Caracas, people are seeing there are much more announcement and statement from the international community. Guaido just said just minutes ago that he's going to discuss the representative they're going to announce for the International Development Bank in the next days. Also, he discussed about PDVSA and CIDGO, and he says he would probably make announcements also on the persons that are going to be named to be in these charges in the United States as he is the president who is recognized by Donald Trump.
Hmm. Laura, how about it? Changes kind of in
yes,
this?
Very much in terms of the leadership. In 2015, there were a bunch of traditional political parties that they were fighting with each other to see which one will one will be, you know, in power? If they get power, who will be president? So they have like a lot of internal quarrels. Right now, we are in presence of a phenomenon. I will say that probably 2 weeks ago, just a few people in Venezuela knew who was Juan Guaido. Just, you know, like, I will dare to say that no more than 2% of population mm-hmm. knew the name of Juan Guaido. And suddenly you have this young man who is not angry, who is speaking, you know, like very rationally. He's 35 years old. He has no history of corruption or, you know, or traffic of influences. Of course, he belongs to a party, but that's not part of the equation right now. Hmm. What is different is you have a young guy with no past attachment that is speaking about the future. And suddenly, from one day to another, he is the president, the interim president of the country. So it's so surprising. And of course, the people in Venezuela, it's been a lot of criticism saying that in Venezuela, we are always waiting for a messiah to come and to solve all our problems.
Yeah, you called it a presence of a phenomenon. Presence of a phenomenon. Great phrase there. Laura Weffer is along with us, co-founder of Efecto Cucuyo. You can join our conversation, the fast-moving developments in Venezuela, the effect here in South Florida, the role that South Florida is playing in Venezuela, certainly as well. 800-743-9576. Do you have friends or family there? Colleagues, have you done business perhaps there? 800-743-9576. Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, self-sworn-in interim president this week, Juan Guaido, the leader of the National Assembly, in a power struggle, the United States and many Latin American countries recognizing Guaido as the leader of Venezuela, but Maduro certainly not giving up power. Tim Padgett is with us, a veteran Venezuelan reporter and America's correspondent, for that matter. Talk to us about the historic nature of this. This presence of a phenomenon is how Laura presented it.
Yeah, and if I could just add one factor that Laura did not mention that I think is even more key about Guaido, not just his youth, but the fact that he does not come from the elite in Venezuela. He's from a fairly working middle-class city on the coast called La Guaira. His family, for example, in 1999, during huge floods and mudslides there, their home was destroyed. That doesn't happen to elites in Venezuela. So I was going back and looking at conversations Mario and I had back in 2014, and we both agreed that unless the opposition in Venezuela started reaching out more effectively to the poor and working class in Venezuela, meaning the political base of the socialist regime, it was not going to get very far. It is only recently that it has begun doing that, and Guaido is kind of a very strong manifestation of that trend, that the opposition realizing that it's got to reach out to the poor in Venezuela. And so I think, that is really the phenomenon that I think Laura is talking about.
Juliette Pineda with Efecto Cucuyo with us via Skype in Caracas. How is that message being received in Caracas and in some of those neighborhoods that Tim spoke about?
Well, just like Laura said, people feel this is a leader much closer to the people because he's young person. Here, for example, Nicolas Maduro says the political parties from the opposition are flawed by dinosaurs. And Juan Guaido comes from a generation from students who were adverse to the regime of President Hugo Chavez. So, like they both say, he doesn't have a record of corruption behind him. He doesn't have this record of stained by the previous negotiations with the government, and they see he puts out that future that people are waiting that message to fill in.
Yeah. Mario Di Giovanni with Red Democratica International, the NGO based here and in Caracas. What about the diaspora kind of reaction to Guaido, not to his swearing himself in, but to him as the face of the opposition now, the leadership position that he's in?
Well, like we were saying before, I think many of the typical leaders that we have seen in the past few years had so much baggage that each one had their own stain, if you may. But once this guy, this young guy comes up and suddenly starts, you know, without fear, because that's what many people have said. You feel that he's talking calmly, he's talking with confidence. He assumes this responsibility, this big challenge that nobody thought anybody would assume. Many people have changed their minds in about what's going to happen to Venezuela. So he has really, the hope is really there right now, and Venezuelans are waiting to see what happens and helping or trying to, like I said before, communicate with other countries that we need their support, and we need to, for them to understand that this is not one half against the other half. This is the vast majority of Venezuelans trying to overcome a dictatorship.
And this week we saw pieces of the Florida congressional delegation meet with President Trump, Tim, and walk out of that meeting expressing hope that the president was going to recognize Guaido as the leader. Senators Rubio and Scott were there. Mario Diaz-Balart, the representative, and Governor Ron DeSantis, in fact, traveled from Tallahassee to Washington to make that plea, and it seemingly worked.
It did. And this is really Marco Rubio in particular had really been pushing hard to take this measure. And but the question is, what other measures are the United States going to have to take? For example, there's a lot of talk now about the next step being to cut off Venezuelan oil imports to the United States. That would have a big financial effect. We import almost about $10 billion worth of oil per year from Venezuela, which is significant because that's more than what their foreign reserves are right now total. The problem is, how much of pain would that inflict on the Venezuelan people if we were to do that? But if we were to do it, it would be the kind of pressure that could, as I said before, move the Venezuelan military to start questioning being joined to the hip with this guy.
What are the other levers that the United States may pull here? We've seen the sanction lever being pulled significantly. We've even seen criminal justice invoked here with indictments in the United States of some of the military leaders and others in Venezuela. The president has been adamant, as has others here in South Florida, saying all options are on the table. You quickly get to that statement to asking about military, of course,
which may be on the table, but it's wholly unrealistic. And it would be such a catastrophe, not just in terms of Venezuela, but in terms of the burden it would put on us in terms of having, you know, take part in Iraq style nation building again. So really, there are, aside from the oil move that I just talked about, there really are no other options, which is why they chose this option this week, because they saw it as a way of creating some really heavy, significant symbolism that the rest of the international community and Venezuelans inside Venezuela could rally around without going to the invasion option.
The military option, yeah. Meantime, on the streets of Caracas, Juliette Pineda with Efecto Cucuyo with us via Skype in Caracas. Just let us, you know, how is life in the city? How is life in Venezuela? We know it's very, very difficult for food, for medicine. Inflation is running at an unbelievable amount. Tell us, what should South Florida know about life in Caracas this week?
Yes, well, even though we're having these big demonstrations these past few days, life in Venezuela is still tough. You go to the supermarket and you still cannot find basic products. The inflation rate, it's calculated at around 4% each day. Medicines are, well, we have this huge shortage right now, and it's basically impossible to acquire just something as simple as an antibiotic with just the minimum wage Nicolas Maduro announced a few days ago in his speech. So right now the situation keeps deteriorating, and the demonstration that happened on Wednesday gave the people of Venezuela some certain hope to see this could finally change. You know, this could mean a real change in a few weeks, a few months. And having the support of the international community, I think it's contributing to to that hope the Venezuelan people are currently feeling.
Yeah. Juliet, 4% daily inflation. The United States inflation rate is 2%, barely 2% a year.
And it's running in excess of 1,000,000% annualized.
Year. Yeah, unbelievable. Right, Preston in Coral Gables wants to join the conversation. Go ahead, Preston. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I study global economics at the University of Miami, and I, you know, while obviously the Maduro regime is a problem, and, you know, we welcome anyone that's going to sort of shake things up and make things better for the Venezuelan people, I think that I'm a little leery because we don't really know a lot about Guaido right now. And so I'm kind of leery of the international community, particularly certain fascist regimes like in Brazil, kind of embracing a figure that we don't really know a lot about, especially when we consider that a lot of the economic plight that it has been dealt to the Venezuelan people was because of different embargoes put on them by different organizations that are led by, you know, the United States or other proxies.
Preston, good question. Laura, I'm going to put that to you first. There's a lot of hope, obviously, that you express that Venezuela's having Guaido, fresh face, young man, different background than the usual political class. But what do we know about, frankly, his, you know, what he wants to do, policies, economic policies, social policies, those types of things?
Yeah, I think one important thing about him is that he is, because he knows that he doesn't know, and because I think this took him to surprise also. I mean, today we found a tweet that he published in 2008, when he said, you know, one day I will be the president, the Twitter president. But he wasn't referring to Twitter, but like the president of the country that will go through Twitter. So probably he had this idea that one day he will be president, but it caught us totally surprisingly. It was a surprise for all of us.
It's okay, Laura. Mario DiGiovanni, let me ask you, in terms of the diaspora here, asking policy questions at this point seems early and premature, but Preston brings up a good question, which is, you know, a lot of hope, a lot of ambition for the opposition has been directed at Guaido in the last 72 hours, justifiably so, perhaps. But what do we know about, if he is successful, what that would mean for certain kinds of policies for Venezuelans?
Well, one thing that we must consider from Guaido is that he belongs to the Popular Will Party, the Voluntad Popular, which is headed by Leopoldo López. This is a center-left political party, so from there you can already see his stance. So saying that this could be a far-right coup or something, it could be really going against to what he has represented for the past few years and what he currently represents.
Mario DiGiovanni, along with us from Red Democratica Internacional, a non-governmental organization promoting democracy in Venezuela. Laura Weffer, co-founder of Efecto Cucuyo. Her colleague, Juliet Pineda, along with us via Skype from Caracas, and Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLR. And all four of you, thank you very much for updating
with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
We are monitoring some news out of Washington as well. President Trump is expected to make an announcement, some kind of statement regarding the government shutdown. When that begins, we will bring it to you here on WLR. In the meantime, more from the roundup after this. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Miami Beach is going after nuisance crime, stuff like drinking in public, urinating in public, and being in parks after dark. Using public records, the Miami Herald found the crackdown involved mostly homeless people. The Herald analyzed more than 200 cases between mid-January and mid-August of 2018, finding at least two-thirds of those cases involved a homeless defendant. Joining us to discuss this finding, the Herald's Kira Gurney, who covers the Miami Beach for our partner, the Miami Herald. Kira, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup.
Thank you for having me.
Phones are open as well. If you have any experience with this on the beach, questions about all of this, 800-743-9576. Treatment of homeless people in South Florida, 800-743-9576. So tell us more about the cases overall, the types of cases here that you looked at?
So Miami Beach created a municipal prosecutor program about a year ago, and they're the only city in Miami-Dade County that has this type of program. And basically, they have their own prosecutor who prosecutes people who are arrested for things like drinking in public and the other crimes that you mentioned. And while you would expect that some tourists would also be arrested, because Miami Beach residents often complain about tourists mm-hmm. being drunk in public and that sort of thing, what we found was that it was only about 12 or maybe 15 people who could have been tourists based on their driver's license on the arrest records who had been arrested and prosecuted as part of this program. The vast majority were homeless people, and some cases they had been previously warned or previously arrested, and in others it seemed as though they had simply been, you know, arrested for drinking a beer on the beach, which is behavior that you often see tourists and residents in Miami Beach doing as
well. Tell me more about this special prosecutor. Maybe that's not the title, but this city prosecutor that is working solely for the beach?
Yes. So the city prosecutor essentially prosecutes the crimes that that previously the state attorney's office would have prosecuted.
Right. That's where normally would kind of handle a case on behalf of the people of Miami Beach.
And what happened is city residents and city officials in Miami Beach were frustrated because the state attorney's office obviously has a huge caseload, and so they were routinely dropping these types of minor charges. And so the city decided they would pay for their own prosecutor to make sure that people essentially spent more time in jail for this type of behavior.
So the data shows 2/3 of these cases that have been filed in the time period you looked at were filed against homeless people as defendants. What's been the response from city officials and police officials?
So mostly what I've heard from city officials is that they still think this program is a success. They feel that it's decreased the number of arrests for nuisance crimes. Hmm. And they also say that some of these homeless people are, you know, I've been told several times, criminal homeless. I'm not sure that most activists
are using that phrase.
So some city commissioners and residents and city officials kind of differentiate in their minds certain groups of homeless people. But I think what most
activists... And just to be clear, being homeless is not a crime.
It's not a crime, although it is against municipal ordinances, for example, to camp in prohibited areas.
Right.
But I think what a lot of activists and public defenders would say is that there are more efficient and perhaps more humane ways of helping people who are homeless, and that it doesn't exactly do the city much good to just throw people in jail and then have them released and often return to the beach.
With these dozens of cases, are there services that are provided for these homeless defendants beyond just being called to court or being written a summons or a fine for that matter?
So Miami Beach does have a homeless services office, and they do provide and offer a lot of services. It's not always clear in the police interactions based on the arrest reports whether services were offered, although some arrest reports did say that services had been offered. Mm-hmm. And there were definitely cases where the homeless person had refused those services and then been arrested.
The mayor of Miami Beach, Dan Gelber, told you that the people prosecuted were, quote, mostly repeat and habitual offenders. What did the data show in terms of the habitual nature of some of these folks that were arrested?
So it's hard to say for
and
sure.
And am I using that term right? Were they arrested?
Yes, they were arrested.
They were, okay.
And so it's hard to say for sure how many were habitual offenders, because we only looked at about 7 months of arrest records.
Sure.
But out of those 7 months, I think it was about 78 or 80% had only been arrested once during that time period. There definitely were arrest reports from homeless defendants who had been arrested multiple times. And that is something that is very frustrating for the police department and for residents. But again, a lot of, you know, public defenders and other activists say that in their view, there are more efficient and more helpful ways of dealing with these kinds of issues.
Talk to us about that, because we've seen the treatment of homeless people in Fort Lauderdale, for instance, become an issue. The tent city that was near the downtown area near Las Olas had to be dealt with. There was a gentleman who ran afoul of some law when he was feeding the homeless people without certain kinds of permits. So Miami Beach isn't alone in trying to deal with this issue and coming under public scrutiny. But for those advocates, what are those other avenues that they're pointing to?
Yeah, Miami Beach definitely isn't alone. I think this is something that a lot of cities struggle to figure out the best way to handle. But there is sort of a growing movement nationwide away from arresting and jailing people for low-level offenses. And you also see a lot of homeless courts popping up in different parts of the country. Mm. And interestingly, Fort Lauderdale opened up a homeless court earlier this month. And basically, when someone is arrested for drinking in public, for example, they would be sentenced to community service and given services instead of spending time in jail.
This also brings up the issue of the Pottinger case when it comes to the city of Miami, which was a case, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Kira, that essentially directed the police not to arrest homeless for doing kind of just normal life functions on the street. That case and that ruling is being challenged again. But the approach of municipalities and how they treat homelessness and how they treat homeless people, what's driving that evolution in your estimation?
I think there's a nationwide sort of push for criminal justice reform. And I think that has also sort of impacted the way that people view arresting homeless people for things like panhandling or drinking in public, that sort of thing. But definitely, like you said, it is an issue that a lot of cities struggle to figure out the best way to handle. And Miami Beach is not alone in that.
And Miami Beach's program with this special prosecutor continues to move forward.
It does continue to move forward. There have also been discussions at public meetings about expanding the program so that additional crimes like trespassing, which are currently prosecuted by the state attorney's office, would also fall under the jurisdiction of the city prosecutor. I don't think that's likely to happen. When I spoke with the state attorney's office, they did not seem very receptive to that idea.
And were these arrests centralized in any way, or were they spread across all of Miami Beach?
They were spread across all of Miami Beach, but definitely I did see a lot in tourist areas, you know, Loomis Park near Ocean Drive, yeah. Areas that are frequented by tourists.
Kira Gurney, taking a look at a crackdown on so-called nuisance crimes, stuff like drinking in public and being in parks after dark in Miami Beach. Kira is with our partner, the Miami Herald. She covers Miami Beach for the Miami Herald. Thanks, Kira. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
We got more to come here, including the latest trend taking hold in South Florida, banning plastic straws. Do you support it? Have you changed to paper straws? Have you changed to no straws at all? How do you think that this will go over in restaurants in South Florida? 800-743-WLRN. That comes up next as the South Florida Roundup continues. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Fort Lauderdale is the latest city in South Florida to ban plastic straws. On Tuesday, city commissioners voted to approve an ordinance that prohibits the sale or distribution of plastic straws in city facilities and restaurants. The law will go into effect next year. Now, several other cities in South Florida have enacted similar anti-straw bans. Hallandale Beach's ban began this month. It'll begin in April in Deerfield Beach. Delray Beach could become the first city in Palm Beach County to ban plastic straws from restaurants. Its final vote is scheduled for March. Now, in a week, on February 1st, Miami Beach will begin enforcing its ban on plastic straws and bags for city properties and sidewalk cafes, namely those on Ocean Drive. So here we are. Have you dealt with a shift away from plastic, away from plastic bags or plastic straws? Are you for or against a plastic straw ban? Here's what some of our listeners had to say.
My church made me aware of the problems with plastic straw a year or two ago. They use pasta for coffee stirrers because they're biodegradable, and I only use straws for building tear cakes, and I think I've had the same package for about 10-plus years. I usually use sippy cups when I'm drinking. I even take one to Panera for coffee so I can take the cup with me but not use a disposable.
Banning the plastic straws is one great step, and I'm hoping that all of the eco-friendly, non-toxic, reusable straws might be a great replacement. They appear to be already available in the markets.
Banning plastic straws is like putting a Band-Aid on a gunshot wound. The reality is that straws represent just a tiny fraction of the plastic waste generated each day, and they'll simply be replaced with paper ones that end up in landfills.
800-743-WLRN is the telephone number to join our conversation. Plastic straws, banning plastic straws, 800-743-9576. And I'll correct myself. The Delray Beach vote, final vote on the potential ban of plastic straws is scheduled for February, not for March. I apologize. Cat in Coconut Creek says, I do not use them. I use reusable cups for my coffee and water. Justin in Miami, I use them. Don't see a ban on straws affecting me at all. Plenty of ways to drink a drink, Justin says. Sandra in Palmetto Bay, a ban would be especially awful in Florida during hot days when icy drinks are consumed. Could use stainless steel straws Bring your own or buy one for a dollar to become an alternative to paper. Claudio in Fort Lauderdale wrote us, I work for Royal Caribbean. We had to step back from a total ban. It impacted our guests with disabilities who could not lift a glass on their own. Joining us on the telephone now is Kevin Rader, state senator from Delray Beach. He is with us. Senator, welcome to WLRN, the Florida Roundup. Appreciate your time today.
Absolutely, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you have proposed legislation that would take this plastic straw ban from some individual municipalities that you're seeing here, some in your district, and apply it statewide. Why do you think this is an idea that the state government needs to get involved with?
Well, thanks for asking that question. Let me start out by saying it's a ban on plastic carryout bags and plastic straws, not just plastic straws. I think the carryout bags are a little more serious.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the governor just recently announced last week a $2.5 billion initiative to clean up our Florida's waterways, and I support that initiative. But part of that must include eliminating an obvious pollutant and danger to our environment, and that's plastic bags and plastic straws. These initiatives will, when passed, have like an immediate positive impact on our polluted waterways. It'd be instituted, removing toxic, dangerous chemicals from our waterways.
So let me ask,
that fishermen and anglers they see this and the negative impacts every day about the pollutants in our waterways, and we must take bold steps to put an end to that.
So in real terms, your legislation, if passed and signed into law, would effectively prohibit the ubiquitous Publix plastic bag. Is that right?
Yes. The plastic carryout bag is what it says in the legislation. Not the what where you separate fruit when you're getting produce, but the actual plastic bags at the end. Where it's so common now in our society of using recyclable.
Sure. Now I know some.
There's one thing I also wanted to say. There's one. All your listeners have chimed in. I was listening to it, and one of them said on the cruise ship they. Disabled. I do have an exception for disabled people mm-hmm. who can use due to a disability or medical condition. That plastic straw would be obviously not would be suitable for their use.
So some cities, some municipalities have gone the route of taxing plastic bags to provide a bit of a revenue stream. Your proposal would go a different direction and not tax them, but ban them. So what is a company, what's a consumer supposed to do given the ubiquitous nature of this?
Well, let me say this. This is, I believe, in the state of Florida's history, the first example of putting this forth, and it's a discussion point. Do we want to put a fee or a tax on it? Do we want to do preemption out of Tallahassee? Do we want to do recycling instead for plastic bottles, like a bottle deposit bill or something of that nature. But all this is part of the greater discussion, and it needs to start. And I believe Governor DeSantis, when he announced this $2.5 billion initiative mm-hmm. last week, I hope he's part of wanting to create a solution and, have bold statements that he's going to be an environmental-friendly governor.
Senator Rader, let me bring in Jason Emmett via Skype. He is president of Duffy's Sports Grill. It is a restaurant chain with quite a footprint in Florida, in South Florida, more than a dozen restaurants. Jason, welcome to WLRN and the South Florida Roundup. The senator's bill would ban plastic straws. It would ban plastic bags. What kind of impact could this have on the restaurant business generally, but specifically your business? You use plastic straws and plastic bags for takeout, for instance, Jason.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Tom. And yeah, listen, there's an impact, of course. And we've been watching this pretty closely. This has been coming for a while. This has been a very popular initiative to get rid of plastic straws before it became a legislative one. And we first took some initial steps to at least limit our usage of plastic straws and not no longer just giving them automatically. That's the first thing we've done, and just give them upon request only. So at least we're not just wasting unwanted straws. The challenge for us has only been in finding a real quality solution or quality alternative to the plastic straws. The initial ones we've tested as we've begun looking at this process have just not held up to our standards, and they disintegrate. If you've ever used a paper straw, we haven't found one yet that can withstand, you know, the test of time, sort of, that plastic does, unfortunately. We recognize it's a problem. I applaud the senator's sustainability efforts. I think it's a needed conversation. I think it goes beyond just plastic straws and bags, but I think it's a good first step. And so we'll adapt as necessary, and I think that we're on board to do whatever's needed to adapt and evolve with the times.
Some of our listeners responding to the plastic straw issue, Reggie in Hollywood, I need to ban plastic straws and plastic bags. Those things pollute the environment and kill wildlife and fish. Kathy in Boca Raton, I use straws every day. I like paper straws, she says. They don't last as long, but I would rather have something earth-friendly. She also writes, I can do metal straws, too. No big deal. Christian and Davey, what the heck? Is there a cost-efficient alternative? I need my straws, Christian writes us. Karen in Riviera Beach is on line one. Go ahead, Karen. You're on the radio.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have tried glass straws, which break too easily, metal straws, which are too cold, and I found that wheat straw that is harvested after the crop is taken in has worked the best. It's not dyed, it's not processed. Sometimes the size may be uneven, but it still pulls the drink up, and you can wash them if you want to and reuse them, but that so far has been the best for me.
All right, Karen, wheat straws could be a boon for the state of Kansas if that catches fire here in Florida. Yvonne and Kendall wants to talk about plastic bags more generally. Go ahead, Yvonne. Thanks for calling in. Yvonne and Kendall, you with us?
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. You're probably organizing your plastic bags, maybe. Go ahead. You're on the radio, Yvonne.
Oh, listen to me. This is so ridiculous. You're probably too young, but you remember days ago when you had to carry your bag to the store?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have all these bags? You go to some store, you buy two pins, they give you six plastic bags.
Yeah.
What are you supposed to do?
Yeah.
We are drowning our environment and therefore killing ourselves with all this plastic. I don't even use a straw. What do I need?
Gotcha. Yvonne and Kendall, thank you. Senator Radar, to Yvonne's point, what are the alternatives? Not that you need to propose those in legislation, but what do you anticipate those alternatives being for grocery stores, for restaurants like Jason's, and for other places where they have come to rely on plastic bags?
Well, I think the first thing that I would do in greater detail is take a look at what other areas and what other states and municipalities and counties and what they've done. I mean, I know there's plastic ban in numerous of places: Los Angeles, Washington D.C., New York, Austin, Texas. Like there's literally, I'm just trying to name bigger cities: Portland, Maine, Seattle, Washington. There's other municipalities and places that have done this, and they're not going out of business. Restaurants are thriving. Business is thriving. Grocery stores are doing very well. How were they done up until a number of years ago?
Mm-hmm.
I just recently watched something in one of the news magazine shows at night that we all know of, and they were showing on the island of Midway the carcasses of birds, and the only thing that hits Midway, which is known for a famous World War II battle,
yeah,
is animal lice and habitation. And they're all full of plastic in their bellies, and the only thing that gets there is through waves of the ocean.
Yeah.
We must be, and I actually like Jason's comment. I would love to work with him, hear from him, talk to him more, the fellow from Duffy's MVP Grill, which I enjoy going to, because there is a corporate responsibility in moving forward and doing the right thing. I think it's going to be very hard to find people who think, oh, no, using plastic bags and wasting them and throwing them in and I think on your own public PBS website,
Well,
75% of all plastic bags get to the landfills in the national environment.
Well, let me
need to do something.
Yes, I mean, we've only got about a minute left here, but what would you like to ask Jason Emmett, Senator Rader? I mean, it's somebody who is on the front lines who could be potentially impacted by this legislation.
I'd love to go into one of his restaurants with him and talk to some of his customers and see what they have to say.
I'm sure you'd be invited to do just that.
You know what? The first thing you do is you start asking some of your constituents. You start asking people in the state of Florida.
Yeah.
You start asking what drives our tax base, which is tourism.
Yep.
And you ask people, like, so what do you think? Do you think this is a good idea? Do you think you think this legislation is just onerous and just too problematic?
Yeah.
Or do you think we should be good custodians of our environment and our in doing policy like this.
Senator, we got to leave it there. The session coming up in just a matter of a few weeks, I'm sure you will be getting an earful, and we'll continue to watch it as well. Senator Kevin Rader from South Florida here proposing a statewide ban on plastic bags and plastic straws. Jason Emmett, thank you, Jason, for your time as well. The president of Duffy's Sports Grill, appreciate you sharing perspective with us, too.
My pleasure.
Thanks,
my
folks.
Pleasure.
Our program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our director of radio programming is Jason Zapka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.